Sagar and Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
The Democrats are set up to rule the country, and the Republicans are set up to be critics of the way the Democrats are ruling the country. And that's a sort of a fact of life that we have to deal with now. Look, I do foreign policy. It's not my job to put together a new Republican Party. But as an interested newspaper reader and registered Republican, I want to know, what is the Republican plan to become a ruling party, a rival ruling party, and not just a critic of the ruling party that we have?
Once again, we have an incredibly exciting episode to close out the month of February with. We have brought Mike Duran, senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, back to the podcast. When we recorded with him back in fall 2019, it was one of my favorite episodes. Mike has been a person who's always spoken with Sagar and I about our podcasting plans, the idea behind the realignment, and his focus on foreign policy, especially as that foreign policy's picture has shifted during the Trump administration, made him the perfect guest to speak with. But also, I have exciting news that I want all of you all to follow up on. Mike and I are actually launching a podcast next week called Counterbalance. It is going to focus strictly on foreign policy. It's going to get into these debates about China, the Middle East, the Biden administration. We have a link to our trailer in the show notes. So I will do my favorite thing in the world, which is ask you all to subscribe. Give us a 5-star rating before it comes out. We're going to have multiple ways to do that with you. And we're really pumped for the show.
Yeah, it was great talking with Mike again. It's been a long time. Mike is an old friend of the show. Without Mike, the show really wouldn't really exist. And he's somebody who supported Marshall and I's work from the very beginning. Mike is a right-wing populist in the foreign policy sense, but also an intellectual in his own right. And we are obviously coming at this from three different places here. And it was a fun debate and discussion about the nature of Trump, his effect on the administration, and the way that people think about China, but also an interesting discussion at the top around Joe Biden, exactly who and what he is, whether he's a weather vane, ideological, what that means for all of us. Anyway, if you're interested in the right after Trump, or really in how Washington works and how elite groupthink and more can change, this episode is a great one for you.
The key thing about Mike to understand is the point Sagar about how he's actually an intellectual. Mike is a former professor. He taught at Princeton. He went to Stanford. He worked in the White House and the State Department during the Bush administration. So at the end of the day, this is a person who isn't merely talking about these ideas of populism because it's fashionable. It's because he, whether you agree or disagree with him, is putting a lot of deep thought into this. And that's the part that I really appreciated. Something we've always focused on the show is this idea that there are folks who will see the world changing in DC and not change their approach. Mike, like it, hate it, love it, is someone who firmly did that the past 4 years. So it's really great to speak with him.
Absolutely. Okay, so you guys know the drill. Make sure you subscribe to therealignment.substack.com. Get your weekly newsletter fix. It's going to get you transcripts, other resources for the show. You can check that out there. Give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. Really helps people find the show. And with that, let's get to the question and answer period.
As you all know, the way you get a question to us, leave a 5-star rating with a review with the question inside of it, email us at realignmentpod@gmail.com, or leave a comment on our Substack. Today's question is a very straightforward one. It's short. It's simple. What is Clubhouse? Why did you guys have a contest? Great entries, by the way. Hope everyone is enjoying the platform that's joined so far. We'll be doing this again soon. But Sagar, what is Clubhouse?
Okay, yeah, I guess we should have explained that. We talked about it here. Clubhouse is an invite-only iPhone app, new social media network, recently valued at $1 billion. The best way to describe it is it's basically live audio, and you can think of it a little bit like a radio show, as in there are people who can be talking. But the cool thing is that Clubhouse basically is the facilitator for if you were want to call into a radio show, as in it lets you raise your hand. You can come up and talk to some of the people who are on the stage, quote unquote, and are having a discussion. And it actually enables a lot of people to be having a conversation all at the same time. So that's it at its very most basic level. It's an app that Marshall and I have been spending some time on, having actually a pretty good time. Why I think it's cool is there are just some random people that you can talk to that you never would in real life. I think I mentioned here on the episode, I talked to Ai Weiwei, who was a Nobel Prize laureate Chinese dissident. Marshall and I have had conversations on there with people who are on the West Coast, people who in Europe. There are Silicon Valley billionaires, there are journalists, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a cool place.
Couldn't put it better myself. Let's dive into this episode. I'm really excited. Huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. And one last time, listen, rate, subscribe to Counterbalance on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to anything else. Mike Duran, welcome back to The Realignment.
Great to be here.
Good to see you, Mike.
Good to see you, Sagar.
This is exciting on a couple different levels. Level number one, it's great to have you back. You probably don't know this, but until Sagar went on Joe Rogan and the podcast blew up a bit, you were our number one episode for 8 months. So there is something to the Mike Duran experience that our listeners really appreciated.
I'm very disappointed to hear that Joe Rogan beat me.
Now, let's see if we can replicate a little bit of the Duran magic. That's the real.
Oh, that's the real you're setting the bar very high. Really. So you're putting putting me under a lot of pressure here.
Yeah, and speaking of pressure, we're making a quick announcement for a bunch of our listeners. Mike, you and I are going to be launching a podcast called Counterbalance based out of the Hudson Institute next week. It's going to air on Wednesdays. We're going to have a link to the actual trailer and the ability to subscribe in our show notes, but it's really cool. We're going to talk about foreign policy, institutions, political correctness, all the good stuff that everyone loves. So this is a cool chance for us to plug the show a bit, but also talk with you about the conversation we had last fall 2019, which hit upon a lot of the themes that we're going to go into during the show.
But Marshall, before we start talking about those things, let me just ask, do you think Sagar is jealous that you and I are going to have a podcast?
You know, Mike, I have this thing called Rising, so it's all right. I don't even have the time in the day.
Rising, what's that? Never heard of it.
Yeah, I know. Oh, it's that thing that got you on Fox News. We don't have to do this. It's okay. Go ahead, Marshall.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's just start here. When we spoke with you last, our conversation really focused on this idea that despite everything that was going wrong or right in the Trump administration, there would be no way that we as a society, as a world even, could go back to the world in 2015. That's a world where we had Brexit first, and then President Trump's nomination in the Republican Party, and then his actual victory in the presidency in 2016. Yet, despite all that conversation, Joe Biden is now our president. So in many ways, it feels as if whether or not the policies go back, there's clearly a set of the American electorate that wanted to go back to 2015. So what do you think as we think about these ideas? Because Sagar, you and I have always spoken about this over the past 4 years.
You know, this has really been on my mind a lot. And it kind of crystallized for me on January 6th, January 7th, when I got a bunch of emails that in my mind I refer to as the Mike as a friend emails. These are because right on, you know, on January 7th, a lot of people felt, OK, now right wing populism is over and now I can tell Mike what he needs to do. And they basically, Mike, as a friend, you need to go out in the public square and you need to say that you made a horrible, horrible mistake by ever saying anything positive or understanding about Donald Trump and his electorate. You need to beg forgiveness for all that you did to support this horrible, terrible movement. And then maybe you can salvage some of your tarnished reputation. And so that has made me wonder, you know, was this all a complete miscalculation on my part? And when I say miscalculation, I made the assumption that the rise of populism, not just right-wing populism, but populism on the right and on the left, is now here to stay. And that this means, as we've said, a fundamental realignment of our politics. I still believe that. Now I have associated myself with that. I'm an intellectual, or I aspire to be an intellectual. Once you take a position as an intellectual, then you're invested in it, and it's very hard to rethink your ideas. But I'm not ready to rethink. I mean, I will say that the opposition to the populism has been much more virulent and more powerful than I understood. I now understand our politics very differently than I did 4 years ago, but I don't think it's going away. 74 million people voted for Donald Trump. They voted for him for a reason. They're out of sync with a lot of the Republican leadership. I think that the problem is going to be with the Republican leaders, not the electorate. I don't think the electorate is going to turn around and say, oh yeah, well, we actually like those leaders and we like what they've been saying and we're going to rethink our positions. I don't think that's going to happen.
No, I think you're right on that front, Mike, which is that the leadership really, I mean, always has been kind of the problem, and their inability to calibrate is what left an opening for Trump in the first place. And going forward, I think that's going to be even more so of the case, especially if you see in our politics. The fascinating part about Biden is he was basically like created in a lab, if there ever was one, in order to defeat Trump, right? And he himself, and this is the thing, though, which is that we know him now as the Joe Biden of the 2020 campaign. But Biden's been in Washington for a long time. And that's where, I mean, you're a foreign policy guy. That's where I want to keep a lot of this conversation, where I am so fascinated about Biden as a person and how he's going to approach the world. So like when I think about him from my perspective, it's complicated, right? So like Joe Biden, he voted for the war in Iraq. Also, though, in 2006, he advocated the position before the surge. He was like, hey, you know what? Let's just break Iraq up. This entire surge thing is a nightmare. Iraq is a foregone conclusion. It's not going to work. In Afghanistan, 2009, he was the loudest voice in the room, in the Situation Room, saying, actually, guys, you know, this entire surge is going to be a total disaster. A counterterrorism strategy and a light footprint in Afghanistan is all the American people will tolerate. I think he's largely been vindicated of that position, at least from the right. So, like, how should we think about Biden as an actor now in our foreign policy? Because he's weirdly non-ideological. And sometimes he's made some good calls, and other times disastrous ones on China and more. So how are you thinking about him as a commander in chief?
I think, you know, you pretty much hit the nail on the head. I think that he is... a weather vane. I don't really think that you can, down deep, he's very shallow. Like I don't really think that there's a kind of Biden view of the world that anybody voted for. The election was about not Donald Trump. But let me turn it around in a different way and ask you this, Sagar. Suppose you're Tony Blinken, or you're an upper level person in the Biden administration. You're an undersecretary, and you're thinking about your future in the Democratic Party, just your future. And, you know, you want to go from undersecretary, you want to be Secretary of State next time around.
Yep.
How important is it to be close to and liked by Joe Biden? What I mean to say is Joe Biden the future leader of the Democratic Party? Or is it more important to be liked by Barack Obama, who has a podcast with Bruce Springsteen now? Where is the locus of power? Obviously, Biden is in the Oval Office. That means a lot. But for the long term of the Democratic Party, I don't really think that Biden is the guy who's going to be shaping it.
Let's actually get into that then. it seemed to me that in your weather vane comment, you were reflecting the fact that Joe Biden just isn't a particularly ideological guy. That could be a good thing. That could be a bad thing in the sense that there is no such thing as Joe Biden thought that you could apply across his career. What is Obama thought? Because in many ways, if we're talking about why did a lot of people go back and vote for 2015, it's because there's a real portion of the electorate, definitely in the Democratic Party, but just would like President Obama to have a third term. So what is that President Obama forward-looking foreign policy? What does that mentality look like?
I think right now, you know, I can analyze what I do, you know, but for a living, which is the Middle East. I can talk about Obama in the Middle East, but I think if we look at Obama bigger and just the Democrats, forget it, Biden slash Obama right now, there is no such thing as foreign policy. It's all domestic policy. And there is one overriding priority, and that is to destroy right-wing populism, you know, to weaken the Republicans. Biden is president thanks to 44,000 votes distributed over three states. That's a thinner margin than by which Trump defeated Hillary Clinton in 2016. They wake up every morning thinking about that. They go to bed every night thinking about that. Every major policy on foreign policy is going to be designed to undercut the constituencies that could decrease that 45,000 vote gap.
So give us an example of that. What does that look like? I guess to me, that looks like, you know, Justin Trudeau appearing with Biden. This is a recent press conference. And he's like, thank you, Mr. President. Like, you know, it's been a long 4 years or something like that. Or Biden doing like these G8 conferences where him and Angela Merkel and Macron are all like, with the transatlantic alliance is back. And is that what you're talking about? Like, how does this manifest itself in foreign policy?
Well, it manifests itself as the transatlantic alliance is back. What's our priority? Global warming, global warming, and a massive bill to combat global warming, which will undercut industries that support the right wing and build up, you know, a voter base. Democrats are all about creating spending programs that create a voter base and also to rewarding their voter base. So you can see it with what they're talking about, the COVID relief bill. Marshall and I on our podcast next week, which is going to rival this one. I'm sorry, Sagar. We talked with Mike Gallagher, Congressman Mike Gallagher, and he said, what was it, 17% or was it 7%, Marshall? I can't remember, of the COVID spending bill is actually about COVID. Everything else is, you know, rewarding public sector unions and so forth. So all the foreign policy initiatives are going to be designed to build up these Democratic constituencies and to build up the notion as well that the real threat to the American people is the domestic terrorism. We have to mobilize against that.
Yeah, I mean, here's my question, though, Mike. I mean, they won the election, right? Like, are maybe the right's dumb enough for not having tried to do it whenever they were in power? Like, whenever I hear these gripes, and look, I get it. But at the end of the day, like, these are the people who actually did win the election. They have the ability in order to pass this. They're actually using their political capital and to move programs, reward enemies, and more. You didn't see a lot of that under Trump. So, I mean, it's just one of these things where it's like, are they mad at the Democrats for like using and exercising power, which is something the right is just like incapable of doing?
Well, you presented what I said as a gripe. I see it as an analysis. You asked me what their priority is. Now, do I like it? No, I don't like it. I don't, not at all. But yeah, I would tend to agree with the implicit criticism of the right that you just expressed. I mean, one has to look back at the last 4 years and say, why didn't the Trump administration do more to advance its agenda? I think in certain areas it did some great things, but you know, it amazed me. You guys know Brett McGurk, right? He's now in charge. He's the senior director for the Middle East.
Let's explain who he was, for just in case. So he was the guy. He ran anti-ISIS. Yeah, you go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah. So yeah. Brett McGurk is quite a successful Washington insider. I worked with him in the George W. Bush administration. He was in the White House, in the Iraq office of the White House. And he was in the Bush administration, and then he was in the Obama administration. And under Obama, he became the counter ISIS coordinator. So he was running the fight against ISIS. And then in the very last last part of the Trump administration, he broke when Trump started to try to improve relations with Turkey, right when Mattis, the Secretary of Defense Mattis, resigned. McGurk also resigned, and then suddenly became a vocal anti-Trump critic. And join forces with the Democrats, and then now he's in the Biden White House. But McGurk, when a friend of mine told me the other day, when McGurk took over his office in the White House, he fired every official. Most of the people who work in the White House are detailees from other agencies. And so he immediately just dismissed them all. There's nothing wrong with that. That's quite a legitimate way to go about business. But I don't know if you remember back in the Trump administration, when Trump went to dismiss detailees who were leaking against him to the press, who were put in place by Obama and still working with Team Obama to undermine Team Trump. When he went to dismiss it, there was all this hue and cry in the press about how Trump was destroying the careers of these selfless civil servants and so forth. And it actually tied the hands of the Trump administration. Now, I don't blame. I do think the press is ridiculous, right? It's ridiculous that you haven't heard a word about the detailees that McGurk has. Mm-hmm. McGurk dismissed detailees and came in with a list of people that he wanted, right? So that's an interesting question. If the press behaved the way it says it behaved, I'd like to know, how did he come in with the list of detailees that he wanted? Where did that conversation take place with these selfless civil servants who are not supposed to be engaged in political activities? How did a political appointee have a list of all the people that he wanted right from day one? But I'm actually saying this in agreement with you, Sagar, because it's not an indictment of the press, because we know exactly what the press is, and we know how it operates in cahoots with certain elements of the career bureaucracy. But how come Trump, Team Trump, didn't have the people around him with the capability to just brush all of this off and put in place the people that it wanted? And how come it didn't know who the people were that it wanted? That's not just a Trump failure, that's a Republican failure. The mm-hmm. Democrats are set up to rule the country. And the Republicans are set up to be critics of the way the Democrats are ruling the country. And that's a sort of a fact of life that we have to deal with now. I do foreign policy. It's not my job to put together a new Republican Party. But as an interested newspaper reader and registered Republican, I want to know, what is the Republican plan to become a ruling party, a rival ruling party, and not just a critique and not just a critic of the ruling party that we have?
I mean, that's interesting, because that gets into a couple of different things, which is that's the debate over populism, because this is me just being the devil's advocate here. Populism, in the eyes of many people, is doomed to have this situation. What I always loved about talking with you, Mike, is that you would go line by line and articulate what a good, smart version of populism could look like. But critics of that viewpoint who are even sympathetic to the underlying arguments you're making would say, look, populism was doomed to failure. There's this weird necessity of technocracy within Washington, and you know this from your experience, that's required, that might not actually turn into populism. And what you want to have populism do instead isn't to rule things, it's to actually affect and change the way that both established parties actually approach things. So the point wouldn't be that populism is going to be able to permanently rule or govern either party. It would be that populism would say, hey, there's this huge issue. And if you're a political party in the US, if you want to win, you need to address this issue and move forward. So let's take this to the Republican Party then. Especially on foreign policy, because from my perspective, the place where President Trump has probably been the most successful was just on the foreign policy level, in the sense that there's a reason why Tony Blinken, Secretary of State, is not revoking the Uyghur genocide order. Despite right. the tactical debates we could have, that is a Trump shift of a narrative that 2015 Democratic Party is not doing in the same respect. There's a reason why the trade war, despite all the talking before, has not been ended. It's going to be articulated differently. It's going to focus more on human rights and Hong Kong than industrial policy, but it's still going to be there. And then finally, there's a reason why Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, is talking about how the WHO has made all these mistakes. Now that this is no longer a politically partisan issue as it was during the actual campaign. So help us just understand all those dynamics together.
Well, I think there is always going to be just in the nature of who the Republicans are and who the Democrats are. The Democrats, the progressives especially, they know what they want to do with the federal government. They have a vision of it, and they have and they also have a vision of how they want. What they want the federal power to do in coordination with other states abroad. Very clear mm-hmm. understanding of that. And the right wing in a lot of ways is a collection of groups with very different agendas who know what they don't want. You know, what they see as infringements on historic rights and so forth. And they don't really have a clear vision of what federal power should do. They're much better in, you know, in times of real national peril, when there's a existential threat out there, like the Nazis, like the Soviet Union, and so forth, because they're completely in favor of using federal power to defend the republic. But in terms of the having a very clear connection between domestic policy and foreign policy and all the things that they want to do with the Department of Education, for example, or the Department of Transportation. Now we have Pete Buttigieg there. They don't have a vision of that. But I still think, Marshall, that there's a gap. Even if we accept that there has to be something of a gap like that, and there's kind of always going to be the right wing as the party of criticism of the progressives, there's still a Washington game that the Republicans are not playing very well, an inside the Beltway game and a communications game. Look at the power that has accrued to the Democrats thanks to this alliance between Hollywood, Silicon Valley, and the Democratic Party. We're kidding ourselves if we say that isn't real power and they aren't using it as real power. And we can sit and complain and complain and complain, but we've got to come up with an alternative. And I don't see, let me put it to you guys, because you're more in that game than I am. I'm watching the Middle East, you know, the balance of power in the Middle East. Do you see a serious Republican counterplan or the elements of what might be a counterplan to do something about the power that this alliance between Hollywood, Silicon Valley, I'd say Hollywood, Silicon Valley, universities, and just about every, you know, cultural institution that's out there and the Democratic Party?
Go ahead, Marshall. So no, but on two different levels. So level number one is the fact that the Republican Party doesn't have a clear counter, because in many ways, a lot of the things you're talking about, whether it's Silicon Valley, Hollywood, and universities, are sort of apolitical questions. So for example, why are universities so liberal? It's like, well, more liberals go into teach at higher education. You're a professor at Princeton. You've seen this very literally. And the proposition on the right is definitely not that we should have affirmative action for conservatives at the university level. Same thing with Hollywood. That's always going to be an industry that's going to be more left-leaning. And finally, with big tech, There are complicated issues with big tech, but what I consistently find is that people on the right don't have a strong grasp of the actual issues at hand. So, for example, a lot of people on the right I know on Twitter all of a sudden were very, very mad when Amazon took Ryan Anderson's book about transgender issues off of Amazon's website. And they just said, okay, I'm now convinced it's time to break up Amazon. Now, that could be your argument, that could not be your argument. But whenever I push people on that argument, I'm saying, wait, at a core level, all Amazon is a bookseller. Booksellers oftentimes don't host every book. So what is your actual argument from an antitrust perspective?
What is your actual argument then? Sure, I can make a number of arguments. Let me just throw out a couple off the top of my head. Academia. It is not simply the case that academia is left of center because left of center people go in there. You cannot have right-wing views and have a valid academic career. If you have a right-wing view, you are automatically seen as suspect and you won't get a job. Everyone knows this who's right-wing and has ever been in academia. And in fact, the self-selection begins way before you even become a professor. The self-selection begins before you, by the time you go into grad school, about do you really want to spend 8 years or 7 years, 10 years, whatever, getting a PhD when at the end of that, you know, you go through the desert of the PhD or you hack your way through the jungle of the PhD to get to the desert of the jobs that are available for conservatives who've gone that route? No. And but they're also actually using their position in the universities in order to pursue nakedly political agendas. Mm-hmm. For example, I had a friend of mine, not a friend, he's somebody I don't even know very well, who called me up. He's a friend of a friend from an Ivy League university who's a scientist. A hard scientist, and he's a senior scientist. So he's not trying to make his way into the career. And I have to be very careful because I don't want to get the guy in trouble about what I say he said. But he told me about the two things that were driving him crazy. By the way, he's also an immigrant to this country, mm-hmm. and said one of the things that I loved about science is it was career open to talent. If you could do the work, you did it well, you advanced, no matter what color you were, what religion you were, what sex you were, and so forth. And so he told me that there are two things that are really driving him crazy. One is the increasing power of China in the hard sciences. He said, you know, in his field, China offers him graduate students. Mm-hmm. China offers him grants. China offers and the graduate students who come in, they're incredibly dedicated to the work. So they will work for you 24/7. And you know, in the sciences, having drones to do all your research for you is incredibly important. Of course, science also costs money, and they'll give you lucrative grants to go to China to work with them. Right. And he said this is now baked into his field. Secondly, on the American side, the wokeness. He said increasingly, I am being ordered by the leadership in my department to choose people on the basis of sex and color and not on the basis of their ability to do good science in my field. And we're also being encouraged to engage in activities outside of science to build up our, he said it's more important for younger people than it is for him. They have to build up their woke resumes to show that they are committed to social justice in order to do their work in science. Now, I think from a national security point of view on the China question and from a political point of view, I mean, towards building the kind of society that I want to build, we should be, the Republicans should be shining a light on this. There should be research project after research project to talk to these people quietly, to collect the data on what they're doing. You know, and this is incredibly important. This is a political a campaign that the progressives are running in our universities. You cannot, increasingly in biology, you cannot do biology without saying that there is no biological determinant of gender. for example, something that is not acceptable from a scientific point of view. But this is being crammed down all of their throats. We complain about it in the right-wing press, but we should actually be doing things about it. And Sagar, there's a lot that can be done about it. I mean, Marshall, there's a lot that can be done about it. How many state legislatures do Republicans actually have the majority? So there are tons of institutions of higher education out there where this stuff is happening, where Republicans have a majority. And if they took an interest, if they did the research, took an interest and came up with a few simple principles by which they allocated money to those colleges, they could have a major, major impact. But as I think a lot of us have complained all along, the Republicans have completely ceded the culture to the Democrats.
I'm glad that you said that, Mike, because I actually think that's what it comes down to more than anything, which is that at the end of the day, the core critique there is around cultural power. And look, I agree with you, which is that there's all sorts of stuff that you can do in terms of denying funding to programs which are found to violate, you know, basic civil rights protections through the Department of Education and through a state legislature which can control the state university system and granting institutions. Same thing on China. I think the core critique is always going to be that the problem is that, like with the Amazon thing, I'll go back to that, which is that the critique, I don't think there are a lot of actual conservatives out there who are saying Amazon must be legally required to have Ryan Anderson's book. What they're pissed is that Amazon can take down Ryan Anderson's book and their stock price will go up, is that there is no meaningful coalition in politics which exists, which Amazon respects and knows will be a check against its market price or whatever its power, and that they will have forced to respond to that. That's a problem, like you just said.
I think there's more to it than that, though, as well, because Amazon makes its profit. It doesn't make its profit by delivering books and all the goods that are made in China to your front door. It makes its profit on its web hosting services. Mm-hmm. And the government is in bed with Amazon Web Services. So, there's a very serious question to ask is, should this company, I mean, look, I complain about Amazon like everybody else, and I use it all the time because it's so convenient. It's so convenient, so useful.
There's the ad.
There's the ad for Amazon.
Sponsor us, Amazon, please.
however, here's the thing, though. And it always amazes me how well Amazon understands me when I get those little emails telling me, you know, here's a book you might be interested in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, 9 out of 10 times I am interested in that book. And then of course, there's always the Ta-Nehisi Coates book that they're cramming down my throat. There's no reason why they think I want to read Ta-Nehisi Coates, but they that's the agenda that they're pushing. But they know me so well. They know me so well. And I think we all have to be asking, do we really want this company, which has an unbelievable understanding of all that we're engaged in the world, also running the web hosting services for our intelligence services? And this to me seems like too much.
This is true, right? No, that's a fair critique.
They're collecting so much information so about each and every one of us. And they're in bed with the government with the intelligence services. It makes me nervous. There should be firewalls, and not just firewalls. The thing that Russiagate taught me is that the firewalls that I thought were there are not there. They're not there. So the firewalls need to be bigger and stronger. And I think that there's a case that that this company should not be engaged in government activities while it's collecting all this information on us. Mm-hmm. And intelligence activities.
The part that's fascinating there is it still speaks to something I want to push back against a bit. Not your discussion of the firewalls and the data. That's actually a whole other show. And I'm actually really interested in your – Mike, let's actually take a note. We should have a counterbalance episode about that topic with data and the national security state.
No, but you know, I would love to because I am only here talking as an interested citizen. I would love to actually Let's get some of the people who really know nuts and bolts on this and talk to them.
I love us establishing that we're all talkers and don't really know what we're talking about here. But no, but I just want to push on something you said, Sagar, a bit, which is, I understand the context that you're saying it with the whole, this is also about culture and the right has ceded culture. When some people on the right hear that, though, their response is to say, okay, so the answer is for us to create the right-wing culture thing, or the answer is for us to actually try, as if the problem is that no one's trying. Mm. I've been in nonprofit DC world for 5 years. I can promise you there are literally millions of dollars and countless foundations and organizations that are quote unquote trying. So I don't want the takeaway from your point, Mike, to be, hey, you're a 30 something conservative. Your next grift should be, hey, we're going to make the cool Republicans so that we can do power stuff. Because that's the thing that people do. Because the part that's difficult here, and this is where I want to end this, is asking you, is making a statement and asking you a question, Mike. So the quick statement, from my perspective, the second the right decided to go all in on populism as a specific framework and all in on Trump as a specific leader of the party, you know, Jim Jordan today is tweeting out President Trump is the leader of our party in response to Liz Cheney saying he needs to leave. That could be a decision that as a Republican makes sense. But from my perspective, at a strategic level, you should accept that if Donald Trump is the head of your party, then you are not going to lead or dominate the culture in this country. It's just not true. If Donald Trump is the leader of the Republican Party, then it should just be conceded at a strategic level that you are not going to compete in higher ed, you are not going to compete in entertainment, and you're not going to compete in tech, because those are the three structures that the Democratic Party, with its increasingly upper middle class, suburban center-left base, naturally dominates. And that's something you can decide makes sense, but I just don't see a way around that. And the calculus about who leads your party has to factor that in.
I don't think that's necessarily true at all. I think that if the Republican leadership wised up on a lot of these issues and put together the program for the next Republican president, whether it's Donald Trump or anybody or anybody else, that was populist friendly. It doesn't mean it has to be wild eyed, drain the swamp. Just recognize that the priorities in the country have shifted. And you say that you say, Marshall, that the Republicans went all in. The Republican Party went all in. The Republican Party did not go all in. The Republican electorate went all in. The electorate went all in. And it's not my job to go, pointing out Republican leader after Republican leader, but we all know who they are, who basically kind of put their heads down like this for 4 years and hoped that it would all just that the whole thing would just go away. So it's not going. I mean, the thing that you and I think agree on is that it's not going away. So let's put together some ideas that are going to benefit the Republicans in general, the country. More importantly, that address these issues. Let's get China out of our universities. The Biden administration has just lifted restrictions on reporting of Chinese gifts to major universities. Why? How come we're not calling out our major universities for doing this? The public is outraged by it. And where's the Republican leadership on the question? I mean, some people are. Like Tom Cotton are making a big deal about it, but this should be, we should all be speaking with one voice on this. I saw Donald Trump, nobody accuses Donald Trump of being an intellectual, and nobody accuses him of, spending a lot of time reading lots of books and so on. But I watched him on the Middle East, and I watched him shift and change. And basically I will defend his Middle East policy anywhere and anytime. Trump's Middle East policy on its worst day was better than Obama's on his best. Biden is going back to that. But that showed me, I don't believe that Donald Trump knew anything about the Middle East when he came in. Obviously, I mean, Trump always says, nobody knows any more about the Iran than I do. I didn't believe that. But he got to a very good place. So you can, Marshall, you can influence the man, and you can offer him ways forward, but you have to make the case. You have to have the ideas ready. What he will not do is he won't build it for you. Right. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump is what Jesse Jackson called himself. He's a tree shaker, not a jelly maker. But if you hand him the jelly, he can see the advantage of it.
Well,
where's the proof of that? Well, quick before we cut out, because Mike, you keep saying great stuff. So I'm taking down notes for episodes. But other than foreign policy, which is this totally unique space where, frankly, I think foreign policy is a space where Republican leadership most acceded to Trump. It's because it's where it was easiest to really shift the most, especially because of many of Trump's policies were just reversals of whatever the Obama policy was. Where is the evidence that the jelly conception is true in areas other than the Middle East and other than China?
Would you and I agree now that LeBron James and Tim Cook of Apple are now playing on the same team, Team China? And this conversation we're having about our universities being deep in bed with China, that higher ed, Apple, and LeBron James are all on Team China. Now,
can I push back? I want to push back on that for one quick second, because I think that ideas can be operationally true. Well, at the same time, and I said this during the episode, I actually think that Tim Cook and LeBron James are stuck in this weird position where positions they held in 2015 and were totally okay and were totally reasonable within the framework of public policy, all of a sudden in 2019, 2020 became not cool. So because we're realigning on China policy, I don't think it's constructive to go attacking people, given the fact that this is the one area where people's minds have been changed. That's all I'll say. The one area where center-left Democrats have changed their approach was the China issue. And I don't think making LeBron James's, frankly, uninformed, immoral statements the centerpiece of that is going to convince people that this actually is Cold War II.
Then you and I are in total agreement, and you're making my point. Because there's nobody who loves app. I don't follow the NBA at all. I don't even know what team LeBron James plays for. I'm not joking, right?
I couldn't tell you either.
I follow Middle East politics. I don't follow sports. I have limited bandwidth, right? And I'll tell you something else. Nobody loves Apple products more than I do. Right. Mm-hmm. I'm totally just like I use Amazon. Apple is about the only brand that I'm actually loyal to. So I'm not going after those individuals. I'm making a point about the picture we all have in our heads of what the major political landscape. Right. We now see connections. We see all these connections between things that we wouldn't have connected. And that's what you're saying, Marshall. You're saying we've all shifted. Mm-hmm. All of our brains have shifted. Donald Trump shifted our brains. Marshall, Donald Trump shifted your brain. He did. That's an incredible achievement.
And look, that is always, and this is what I said for years too, which is on Trump. I'm like, yeah, look, if there's one thing that he actually succeeded in is making people think pretty deeply about a lot of different things. Despite all of the, there were a lot of crazy reactions and more. You guys are getting into so much. I'm loving it, and I can already tell it's going to be a great pod. I know we're running out of time here, Mike, so we really appreciate it. Where can people find more about
Sagar,
you?
Wait, Sagar, what? You made a huge mistake. You just said we're running out of time, and the audience hates it when we run out of time.
Okay, let me tell you why we're running out of time.
Okay, everyone.
Let me tell everyone why we're running out of time. Marshall is traveling and has a meeting at 4 p.m. It's currently 3:50, so we have to wrap this episode and tape an introduction before that.
Have you ever noticed with people when you're talking to them and they think they're more important than you, and you say, oh, you got, excuse me, I got to go. And they say, yeah, I got to go too.
Right.
It's like, or when you know, like back in high school, you say to the girl, I'm breaking up with you. Right. No, I'm breaking up with you.
Yes.
Right. So we don't have to leave because Marshall has to leave. We have to leave because I have to leave right now.
Mike has to leave literally right now. We are not cutting Mike off for an arbitrary reason. Just to make it very clear.
I have an important appointment with somebody way more important than you. Because that's
where we go. So, and I would much rather prefer it that way. Okay. Thank you, Mike. I could talk to you for hours, sir. Being a good friend and friend of the show. So thank you. We appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. A lot of fun.
Thanks, Mike.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to the episode, guys. We really appreciate it. Make sure you subscribe to therealignment.substack.com. Give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. As always, we appreciate the Lincoln Network for letting us do the work here. We'll see you all next week.